shoulders. Thatcher must have felt similar relief. He leaned against the wall and wiped his perspiring hairline with the back of his hand.
He's a tough old coot.
He is.
Laurel regarded the sleeping Irv with affection as she sponged dried blood off his arm and torso.
But I don't know what I would have done without him.
Thatcher let that hover for a moment, then said,
Tomorrow, when you change the dressing, it probably wouldn't hurt to apply a little coal oil.
I planned to, she said around a light laugh, but I wasn't going to admit it. My mother swore by its healing properties.
Keep the moonshine handy, too.
I also planned to do that.
She used a clean towel to dry Irv's damp skin where she had washed.
Ready to wrap? Thatcher asked.
The girl had left them with neatly stacked bands of cloth. Together, she and Thatcher began winding them around Irv's torso, being as gentle as possible when they rolled him from one side to the other. The room Irv had created for himself wasn't that spacious, but the quarters had never seemed small to Laurel, until now, when sharing it with Thatcher Hutton. As they wound the bandage, their movements were so in sync they could have been choreographed, or perhaps they were just keenly attuned to each other. So attuned, they read each other's mind. Occasionally, their fingertips brushed. When even a whisper of contact was made, she felt his eyes on her, but she didn't have the nerve to look into his. She kept her head down and pretended that her concentration was solely on their task. But her awareness of him was breath-stealing. The five-button placket on his undershirt was open, revealing a wedge of dark chest hair that looked soft. The long sleeves had been rolled up to above his elbows, tightly cuffing his arms just beneath his biceps. Plump veins ran down his forearms all the way to the backs of his hands, which she watched now as long, strong fingers tied a knot to secure the bandage. "It's snug," he said, "but keeping pressure on it tonight will keep the bleeding down."
"Thank you for stanching it when you did."
She glanced over at his discarded shirt on the floor in the corner.
"I'll wash it for you."
"It isn't a favorite."
"That one is worse for wear, too."
He looked down at the streaks of blood on his undershirt. "It'll soak out." Looking away from him, she rested her hand on Irv's forehead.
"He doesn't feel hot now, but I'll keep checking for fever."
"If the wounds get red and puffy or start to stink, call in a doctor. Only please don't tell Irv I was the one who suggested it."
Remembering what Irv had threatened to do if Thatcher took him to a doctor, Laurel bit back a smile. 30. Laurel had learned that the girl's name was Corinne. She had been very useful, eagerly fetching and carrying, handling everything with remarkable efficiency, considering that she had the use of only one arm and limited eyesight. She re-entered Irv's room now.
"There was a pie in the pie safe. I cut each of y'all a piece and started a pot of coffee. Take a breather, I'll sit with the old man. Irv's his name? Never mind that bloody water in the washbowl. I'll pitch it out the window."
"Did you help yourself to some pie?" Laurel asked.
"It looked too good to pass up. I hope you don't mind."
"Not at all. You've been extremely helpful tonight. Thank you."
Corinne shrugged off the thanks and with her free hand made a shooing motion for Laurel and Thatcher to leave the room. Irv was snoring loudly through his open mouth. Laurel didn't think she would be missed. Thatcher followed her into the kitchen. When they were out of earshot of Corinne, she asked quietly,
"Who is that girl? Where did she come from?"
"She works at Lefty's."
Laurel looked toward Irv's room, then back at Thatcher.
"Not upstairs, surely."
The look he gave her said otherwise.
"She's just a girl."
17.
She was about to say more, ask more, but then remembered that Thatcher had been at Lefty's tonight when it was raided, and that what he was doing in the company of a teenage prostitute was none of her business. He stood there, looking down at her as though waiting for her to pose questions she had thought better of asking. Then, stepping around her, he said,
"I'll be right back,"
and went out through the back door. She loaded a tray with the slices of pie Corinne had prepared, cups of coffee and the fixings, and carried it into the dining room, where she laid two place settings on the table. Since she and Irv had begun eating their meals here, she'd bought a second-hand sideboard. At each end of it, she'd placed matching kerosene lamps with milk glass chimneys. Preferring their glow to the glaring overhead electric light, she lit them now. As she leaned down to adjust the flame, her long braid swung forward. Lord! Throughout the ordeal with Irv, she'd lost sight of the fact that she was in her nightclothes, barefoot, her hair plaited for bedtime. But it was too late to correct these oversights. The back door squeaked open. She made certain her housecoat was fully buttoned, flipped her braid over her shoulder, and called, "In here, Mr. Hutton." He must have gone to Irv's truck to get his suit jacket. He'd put it on over his undershirt. His braces were no longer lying loose against his hips, so she assumed he'd pulled them back onto his shoulders. He might also have smoothed down his hair, although it seemed to have a will of its own. In spite of the bloodstains on his undershirt, he looked more respectable and suitable to the setting than she did. They sat down across from each other. She tucked her bare feet beneath her chair, then pulled it closer to the table in a belated attempt to hide her dishabille. She placed a napkin in her lap. As she poured a dollop of cream into her coffee, she noticed that he hadn't yet started on his pie. His hands were loosely fisted on either side of the plate, and he was studying it.
"You don't like peach?"
"Oh, a lot. I was just wondering how you get the crust to wave like that at the edge."
"I fluted."
He raised his head and looked over at her.
"Like this."
She used her fingers to demonstrate.
"To the dough."
"Huh."
He picked up his fork and began to eat. After a full minute of strained silence, at least to Laurel, it seemed strained, she asked,
"Have you been thrown from a horse again?"
"Only once today."
"I was being serious."
He gave a lopsided grin.
"So was the horse."
She laughed softly and shook her head.
"I don't know how you do that."
"Well, I don't know how to flute pie dough."
They smiled across at each other. Then she set her fork on the rim of her plate and clasped her hands in her lap.
"You were right, Mr. Hutton.
Why won't you call me Thatcher?"
For a moment, she was thrown by his interrupting her to ask that. She picked up her fork, set it back down.
"It wouldn't be appropriate for us to use first names."
"How come?"
"Because we're not that well acquainted."
"Using first names would be a start in that direction, wouldn't it?"
All things taken into account, not the least of which was the privacy of this moment, relaxing the rules of etiquette was a risky step she was unwilling to take. Once a boundary was breached, it was difficult, if not impossible, to reestablish. Breaching boundaries with him seemed particularly chancy.
"I think we should leave things as they are."
He didn't respond immediately, but ultimately made a gesture of concession with his shoulder.
"You were saying?"
It took a moment for her to remember what she'd been saying.
"I apologize for the curt way I turned down your offer to help with Irv. I couldn't have adequately tended to him by myself. Thank you for getting him home. Thank you for staying."
"You're welcome, Mrs. Plummer."
He didn't smile, but his eyes, the bluish-gray color of storm clouds, glinted with humor. His amusement made her feel silly and prudish for making first names an issue. But it would take on greater significance if she amended her position on the matter now. Instead, she changed the subject.
"I grew up on a farm. The nearest doctor was 10 miles away, at least. Accidents happened frequently. Even as a girl, I patched up cuts and scrapes, bound up sprains, things like that. I don't faint at the sight of blood, but I never had to deal with a bullet wound before. I hope I never have to again."
"How ammunition can rip through a body can be ugly, all right."
"You're referring to the war? I'm sure you saw some horrific things on the battlefield."
"And in the hospital. Some of the men brought in might have been better off dying on the front. In the hospital, they were just made to suffer longer.
You were wounded?
He shook his head. Spanish flu. I was laid up with it for 3 weeks. 3 miserable weeks.
I lived in constant fear of Derby being blown to bits or dying of exposure to mustard gas, something war-related. But I was just as scared that he would die of flu.
Thousands did.
In some ways, that seems a crueler death than being killed during a battle. Little glory, less heroic.
More of a waste.
He focused on tracing the curved handle of the coffee cup with his fingertip.
I'm sorry about your husband.
His somber tone indicated that he knew how Derby had died. Foley was a small town. Through someone, he would have heard the circumstances by which she'd become a widow. She nodded an acknowledgement of his condolence, then gestured to his empty plate.
Would you care for another piece?
No, thanks. Sure was good, though.
I'm glad you liked it. The peaches came from Parker County. It's famous for them.
I didn't know that. They must be special if you went all that way to buy them. How long a drive is it?
When she realized the dangerous territory she'd carelessly wandered into, her throat seized up.
Well, I didn't go myself.
You sent Irv?
No. A couple of young men who deliver my bakery items were up in that area several days ago. They stopped at a roadside stand and brought a bushel of freestones back for me. It was very sweet and thoughtful of them.
She could kick herself for bringing that up, and then for blabbering on about it. Hadn't she warned Irv that telling too much was the best way to get caught lying? Although she'd essentially told the truth. The O'Connor twins had brought her back a bushel of peaches, but their primary errand had been to deliver several gallons of whiskey to the man in Weatherford who'd sold Irv the copper to make the new still. Mr. Hutton seemed to detect that she was nervously dancing around something. He continued to stare at her over the rim of his cup as he drank the last of his coffee. He returned the cup to the saucer. Your father-in-law is going to mend. She smiled.
I'm relieved.
He'll be ornery for a week or so. Her smile broadened.
I expect so. He's fiercely independent and doesn't like to be fussed over.
I got that about him.
He shifted in his seat, stretched out his long legs at an angle to the table, then drew them back beneath it. He turned his head aside and studied the spandrel with much more absorption than it warranted. Evidently, he wanted to say something, but was hesitant. She waited. Finally, his meandering gaze came back to her.
I hated having to give you a scare tonight.
You mean when you arrived?
I knew it would shock you, seeing your father-in-law like that, the blood and all, but there was just no way to make it easy. At least I couldn't think of a way.
No, there wouldn't have been an easy way. My heart was in my throat.
You must have thought the worst had happened.
Not Irv, too. That's what flashed through my mind.
I saw the fear in your face.
Was it that obvious?
It was to me.
The four words, softly and solemnly spoken, had an immediate and noticeable effect on the atmosphere. He said nothing more, for which she was glad, except that moments into the ensuing silence, during which they just sat there looking at each other, she wished for more dialogue or a movement, no matter how slight. Anything to relieve her awareness of him, which had become both terrible and tantalizing. Her night clothes were made of summer-weight cotton, old and soft from so many washings, but they began to feel like chainmail against her chest, equaling the pressure collecting behind her breastbone. When she could stand it no longer, she said,
I'd better check on Irv.
She pushed back her chair and came out of it so quickly she tripped on the hem of her housecoat. She hadn't quite made it out of the dining room when he touched her arm from behind.
Laurel, wait.
She didn't upbraid him for using her first name. Of greater consequence was that he had covered the distance from the table in half the time she had, and was now standing close behind her. So terrible and tantalizing that she kept her back to him.
What, Mr. Hutton?
Why didn't you ask me about Corinne?
I did ask you about her.
You wanted to know more.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did. He reached for her hand and turned her around, then kept his fingers clasping hers as they faced each other. Why didn't you ask how come she was with me?
Because it isn't any of my business.
Yes, it is. He drew on her hand, bringing her closer to him, close enough for her to feel his body heat. Denying to herself that she felt anything at all, she kept her head lowered and whispered insistently into the open placket of his undershirt.
No, it isn't.
Well, it's about to be. With his other hand, he tipped her chin up. His eyes moved over her face, pausing momentarily on each feature. He brought his hand up to her cheek and rested it there. His thumb stroked her chin, coming close enough to her lips to make them tingle. He lowered his head, then more still, until his face filled her field of vision, and she felt his breath drift warmly over her lips. Her eyes closed. His lips met hers softly, whisking back and forth, sipping gently, teasing her so maddeningly that she came up on tiptoes to secure the connection. He made a low sound as his arm curved around her waist. The hand against her cheek slid beneath her chin, supporting her jaw and neck as he tilted her head and realigned their lips. His were parted. Hers responded in kind. Tongues touched, shyly and fleetingly, but electrically. Breaths caught and were suspended. He waited. For her, it was agonizing. This indecision, this self-denial, this wanting but fearing. But then he spoke her name on a ragged breath, and something inside her that had been fettered for a long time broke free and took flight. He sensed it immediately and deepened the kiss with hunger and heat, a low growl, his tongue searching. His arm tightened around her waist until their bodies met where his was straining and hers was aching. He nudged the dip between her thighs and stayed and pressed, and still it wasn't close enough. She placed her hands on his chest, clutched handfuls of his jacket, and then gave a cry of sudden pain. He released her immediately and backed away. God, Laurel, what's the matter? She looked down at her right hand where a drop of blood beaded up out of her palm.
I don't know.
Mystified, she looked up at him.
Something in your pocket?
She reached into his left breast pocket and came up with a star-shaped badge. She gaped at it, then dropped it as though the pin had pricked her again. The badge clinked against the hardwood floor. She looked up into his face, her breath rushing in and out.
You're a deputy sheriff?
No, not officially. She backed away from him, drawing her housecoat more tightly around her.
Were you in on that raid?
Not by choice.
Either you were or you weren't, she said, raising her voice. If there hadn't been a raid, Irv wouldn't have gotten shot.
If he hadn't have been in Lefty's back room, he wouldn't have gotten shot.
You're blaming him?
No, all I'm saying is that he was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and so was I.
Oh, were you? If Irv hadn't been shot, would you have arrested him?
Wasn't up to me. I didn't arrest anybody. I hauled your father-in-law out of there, carried him to his truck, and drove him home.
For which I've thanked you. Now I want you to leave.
It wasn't my doing, Laurel.
Don't use my name.
I got railroaded into taking part. Laurel, Sheriff Amos.
I don't care.
Sounds like you do. Sounds like you care one hell of a lot.
Will you just go?
What difference does it make to you if I was official or not?
None. Absolutely none. You're... Nothing you do is any of my business. Or didn't I make that clear to you not 3 minutes ago?
He leaned forward and said with emphasis, It was an eventful 3 minutes. True. With desire spreading through her like warm syrup, all sorts of events had taken place in intimate places. To cover her mortification, she went on the offensive.
Why did you keep that badge concealed? It makes me wonder what else you're hiding.
Yeah, then that makes two of us. because I don't think it was the kiss that has got you coming apart. Anger and fear were potent emotions. In the throes of either, one could speak ill-advisedly. In the grips of both, one would be foolish to say anything at all. She'd gone far beyond that, but if she didn't stop now, she could dig herself in much deeper. Drawing herself up to her full height, she said,
"You prevented Irv's condition from getting much worse. Possibly you even saved his life. Thank you. But I want you to leave now, and from now on, stay away from us. Away from me."
He remained as he was, just looking at her, then bent over and scooped the badge up off the floor. "Thanks for the pie." He turned and disappeared around the corner into the kitchen. The back door was soundly pulled shut. Laurel walked backward over to the table, groping blindly for her chair, and when she located it, landed hard in the seat. She squeezed her eyes shut and covered her mouth with her hand. Her lips were still damp from his kiss. She could taste him. Her breasts felt heavy, full, tingly. She didn't know whether to scream with fury, wring her hands with anxiety, or weep because she could never be near him again.
"Miss Laurel?"
She started. Corinne was standing only a few feet away, looking at her with uncertainty.
"Did he leave me here?"
Laurel laid her forehead on the table and hiccuped a sob tinged with hysteria.
"So it would seem."
31.
"And like a damn fool, I believed every word out of his lying mouth and ran off with him."
Corinne finished a slice of bacon and licked the grease off her fingers.
"It was romantic and exciting and all. I kept telling myself that Mama and Daddy wouldn't miss me, that they'd be glad to have one less mouth to feed. There's 11 of us kids. I'm second oldest. Anyhow, on the night Jack and me had set, I snuck out of the house and walked to the crossroads where he was waiting. We hit the open road, laughing and carrying on, waiting to see where destiny would take us. It took us to Lefty's. You gonna finish that?"
The sudden question, asked out of context, roused Laurel from her wool gathering.
"Pardon? You gonna eat what's left of your breakfast?" "Oh, no. Help yourself."
She pushed her plate across the table. Corinne broke a biscuit in half, spooned jam onto it, and popped it into her mouth. At least, that silenced her for several seconds. Laurel didn't know where the girl found the energy or wherewithal to chatter. Both of them had been up for most of the night, taking turns sitting with Irv, waiting and watching to see if he would take a bad turn. He was in obvious pain, but he'd showed no signs of worsening. Except for some spotting on his bandage, there'd been no further bleeding, no fever. At sunup, Laurel had gone to her room to wash and dress for the day. She'd undone her braid and brushed her hair, then plaited it again and wound it into a bun on her nape. As though her loose braid were responsible for her lapse in good judgment last night, this morning she had mercilessly jabbed the hairpins in to secure it. What other excuse did she have for allowing Mr. Hutton to kiss her like that? The crisis with Irv had left her emotionally vulnerable, yes, but she'd always disparaged members of her sex who blamed stupid behavior on frayed emotions. When she had returned downstairs, Corinne was in the kitchen frying bacon. Biscuits were baking. Laurel had been embarrassed by the girl's industry because she felt completely wrung out. When she'd murmured an apology to that effect, Corinne had said,
"You got saddled with me. I'll make myself useful till you kick me out."
When Corinne had been left behind in the middle of the night, Laurel would never have insisted she leave, but now she didn't know what to do about the girl. Or really, what to do about any aspect of her predicament. Throughout the night, Irv's condition had been her primary concern. However, dawn had brought with it jarring realizations. He'd survived the gunshot, thank God, but the repercussions of it, chiefly his convalescence, created practical problems to which Laurel must find solutions, soon.
"So what I think is that he outright sold me to that old bitch."
Laurel's thoughts were so deeply troubling, her attention had again drifted away from Corinne's running monologue.
"Sorry?"
"Gert," Corinne said.
When I came back after a visit to the outhouse, Jack was gone. He'd hightailed it as soon as my back was turned. Gert said I could stay, but I'd have to earn my keep and pay back her investment in me. I caught on quick, though. I could spend the rest of my life on my back, and I would never make enough to earn my keep, plus repay whatever chicken shit amount of money she'd given Jack. But I didn't have nowhere else to go, so...
She gave a shrug, which, to Laurel's amazement, conveyed more resignation than rancor. The girl seemed to have accepted being prostituted better than she herself had being intentionally widowed.
"Most of the time it wasn't so bad," Corinne continued. "But after the hullabaloo that creep Wally Johnson caused, Gert..."
"Wally Johnson? The man who was murdered?"
"Yeah, the night after he did this to me."
She pointed to her face and patted her arm in the sling.
"The sheriff came out to Lefty's and asked did I know anything about his killing. I told him nothing, except I was glad he was dead."
Laurel remembered Irv telling her that he had seen Dr. Driscoll at the roadhouse, attending a girl who'd been beaten. Things had come full circle.
"Anyhow," Corinne continued, "all old Gert cares about is money, money, money. I thought she was going to beat the tar out of Wally for ruining what she called my earning capacity. Now he's dead, she's taking it out on me that my face is messed up and my eye has gone wonky. She's gotten meaner by the day. So last night, when I saw a chance to get away from her, I took it."
"With Mr. Hutton?"
"Uh-huh. He sure is nice. Handsome, too. I clapped eyes on him the second he walked into Lefty's. I thought to myself, now there's a man that might be worth dropping drawers for. Gert must have thought so, too. The bitch pounced, offering her wares, I'm sure. He didn't go upstairs, though. Then after the shooting started, I ran outside like everybody else. I saw Mr. Hutton come out carrying the old man. He laid him in the back of the truck. I ran over, took in what was happening, offered to help if he'd let me tag along. He cussed something fierce. You know how a man does when he's had about all the aggravation he can tolerate? But then he said okay and told me to get in the truck. I didn't give him time to think twice. I hopped in, put your daddy-in-law's head in my lap so it wouldn't be banging around while we was driving. Along the way, though, he started bleeding real bad. I hollered at Mr. Hutton to stop. He came back, took a look, and that's when he pulled off his shirt and stuffed the bullet hole with it. Are y'all sparking?"
These sudden questions of Corinne's continued to throw Laurel. When she realized what the girl was asking, she replied with a definitive no. Corinne giggled like she knew otherwise, then scooted her chair back.
"You go see to Irv. I'll clean up the kitchen."
"Really, Corinne, you don't have to do that. I don't expect anything from you."
"Neither did Mr. Hutton, which is why I think he's right decent. And real serious-like, ain't he? Go on now, before the old man gets cranky. I took him some breakfast. He's probably finished it by now."
Laurel tapped once on Irv's bedroom door before pushing it open. He was half sitting up, a tray on his lap. His lined features were compressed into a frown. As Laurel entered, she asked,
"Are you hurting?"
"I felt better," he groused, "and that girl didn't put enough sugar in the oatmeal."
"I know that you know her name. You failed to mention she was the one brutalized by Wally Johnson and treated by Dr. Driscoll."
"You didn't ask."
Laurel removed the tray from his lap and set it on the dresser. Despite his complaint, she noticed he'd eaten everything. She went back over to the bed and laid her palm against his forehead. He didn't feel feverish.
"Have you used the chamber pot?"
"The girl's already emptied it."
"Did you have trouble getting out of bed?"
"No, I'm limber as a ballerina. Did a couple of twirls while I was up."
At her look, he added,
"What do you think? Yes, I had trouble. Took 20 minutes to take a piss."
He was way past cranky.
"I'll bring you a jar to use in the bed."
"The girl already offered. I told her hell no. I'm not an invalid."
Laurel restrained herself from commenting on that.
"I need to change your bandage."
"That can wait."
He motioned toward the end of the bed.
"Sit down, so I don't have to crane my neck. We gotta talk."
She did as requested.
"What's on your mind?"
"You have to ask."
He would become even more irascible if she pretended not to know what they needed to talk about, so she went straight to the point.
I don't know how we're going to manage things while you're recovering. I haven't figured it out yet.
You're already toting more than your fair share, Laurel. Damn me for getting my fool self shot.
It wasn't your fault. But what were you doing at Lefty's?
Negotiating that new deal you proposed.
Did he go for it?
He listened, but we hadn't shook on it before the deputies came busting in. One fired a pistol into the air. He got everybody's attention, all right. Caused a stampede.
You could have been killed.
Well, I wasn't. But it served as a reminder to me that you're in constant danger.
So are you.
But I've been at it longer, and I'm old. If I got killed, some would say it was past time. But if something was to happen to you, I'd never forgive myself. This ain't a lark, you know.
I do know that, or I wouldn't have agreed to carry a pistol. I realize the dangers and accept them as part of the venture.
What about him?
Who? He lowered his chin and looked at her from beneath his bushy eyebrows. She somehow kept herself from squirming.
If you're referring to Mr. Hutton, nothing about him. He extended us a kindness. I think he would have done the same for anyone.
He didn't, though, did he? There were others hurt, several shot. I was the only one he slung over his shoulder and brought home. Why do you think he singled me out?
Well, not because he suspects anything. To him, you were just another customer having a drink in Lefty's back room.
He said that?
He didn't say otherwise.
That's not quite the same, though, is it? In fact, I've noticed he doesn't say much of anything unless it's called for. Did he tell you that he was there with Sheriff Amos?
He mentioned him.
Strange that he was out there with the sheriff at that particular time.
He said he got railroaded into it.
Railroaded into what?
Into, I don't know, Irv.
It irritated her that her father-in-law was fixated on the one subject she definitely did not wish to talk about.
Never mind him. Let's focus on us.
All right, I'll drop it for now. And anyway, we won't have to worry about secret agents or incarcerations if we don't make and sell product.
Exactly. It'll take weeks for you to fully recover.
Only one.
At least two, possibly three.
Well, we'll see. In the meantime, our daytime activities will continue pretty much as they have been. You'll keep baking and delivering as usual.
I can certainly do that.
How big's our stockpile of product in the cellar?
Fair, but with the business the O'Connors are generating, it won't last long.
Ernie's got some inventory stashed away, he said. You trust those twins enough to send them out there for it?
She liked the young men. They were charmers and had given her no reason to mistrust them, but she didn't trust them enough to reveal the location of the stills.
No.
Me neither. One's Mooney over you.
Davy.
He looked surprised that she knew.
Has he professed himself?
No. I've sensed that he's infatuated, but pretended not to notice. Please, can we get back to the subject?
I'll go out to the still today, bring back Ernie's stash, and transfer it to the cellar. It'll have to last until you're back on your feet and we resume production.
Resume production? Resume? We ain't shutting down, Laurel. Not for any length of time. As of yesterday, we've got 20 barrels of mash fermenting. You planning on just pouring it out, wasting it?
All right. Ernie can do a run when a barrel becomes ready, but until you're up and about, we won't mix more mash, and we'll cut back to just one still.
Irv shook his head.
We've got customers to keep supplied. New ones that you yourself courted. If we stop delivering as promised, they'll start buying from someone else.
His arguments against shutting down were considerations she had already taken into account.
I'll have to help Ernie then. But on the nights I'm at the still, I worry about leaving you here alone and helpless if anything were to happen.
What could happen?
The house could catch on fire, and it takes you 20 minutes to use the chamber pot.
Well, you can't be baking all day and then driving back and forth to the still in the dead of night either.
Why not?
Because I said so.
Irv.
Laurel, we're not arguing over this. I'd bust up both stills myself before I'd put you at risk like that. What I propose, he said, before she could raise another objection, is this.
He grimaced as he shifted his position.
Situate the girl out there.
Corinne?
Set her up in the shack. It'll look like you've taken her on as a charity case. You rescued her from a life of iniquity. She's young and spry. She could walk back and forth over that hill between the shack and the still with no problem at all. She can help Ernie.
Help him make moonshine? That's not rescuing her from a life of iniquity. It's setting her up to commit a crime.
What she's been doing at Lefty's is a crime.
That was imposed on her.
All the more reason this arrangement will be better.
Laurel rubbed her forehead, which had begun to throb.
Does she know anything about making whiskey?
Haven't asked her yet. I wanted to run the idea past you first. Whether she does or not, she can stir mash, she can seal jars, she can box them.
With a broken arm?
It's almost healed. She took her sling off and showed me how she can rotate it. As for the process, she'll catch on quick enough with Ernie teaching her. She can't read, but she's bright enough.
She can't read?
No, but she can talk. Damn can she ever. She's got magpie in her blood. Before I told her to put a sock in it, I heard her whole life story.
Why can't she read?
No schooling. She had to stay at home and help her mother tend the brood. Her two ambitions in life are to learn to read and see a moving picture show. Anything else you want to know?
Yes. Why aren't you worried about her safety at the still the way you're worried about mine?
Because she ain't my kin, and because she's had to live by her wits. And considering how young she is, she's fared pretty good, surviving Wally and Gert and all. You can't bake your pies in that old stove at the shack. And if you weren't seen around town, everybody would wonder where you went off to, especially that Hutton. I'd bet my left nut on him being first to ask where you was at. And you hate that shack.
It was a speech that sounded suspiciously rehearsed.
You have given it some thought.
Wasn't nothing else to do last night except to hurt and think. I don't see another solution. Now send the girl in here. I'll lay it out for her, but I know she'll jump at the chance. She's scared you're going to cast her out for being a fallen woman.
I wouldn't do that.
She went over to the dresser and picked up the tray.
I'll be back shortly to change your bandage.
First, Irv said, you need to drive out to the still and tell Ernie what's happened. He was expecting me out there last night after my visit to Lefty's. He'll be worried.
That'll take me an hour.
My arm ain't gonna rot off in that amount of time.
To make his point, he tried to raise it and winced. In a growl, he said,
next time you see that Hutton fella, tell him I'm grateful. I don't trust him, but I owe him my thanks.
I won't be seeing him anymore.
But when she walked into the kitchen with the tray, he was standing on the back door threshold in conversation with Corinne.
32.
Thatcher wasn't feeling too gracious toward Laurel this morning, and when she saw him, he could tell by her sour expression that the feeling was mutual. The tray she was carrying was set on the drain board with a dish-rattling thud.
Corinne, Irv wants to talk to you.
Her tone didn't invite discussion or argument.
Can't wait to hear what he's grappin' about now.
Corinne shot Thatcher a parting smile, then scuttled around Laurel and out of the kitchen. Laurel waited until Irv's bedroom door was closed, then said in an angry whisper,
I told you to stay away from us.
Only reason I'm here is to get what I left behind last night.
She propped her hands on her hips.
Corinne?
He didn't blame her for being mad about that. He'd been so miffed when he left, he'd forgotten all about the girl until he'd reached the boarding house. He sure as hell wasn't going to come back for her then.
I didn't mean to dump her on you.
What did you mean to do with her?
Well, I really didn't have time to mull it over, what with keeping your father-in-law from bleeding and all.
Tell me, deputy, did you save him last night only so you could arrest him this morning?
To hell with this. He had things to do that didn't include swapping snide remarks on her doorstep.
I came for the pistol, I could have bought another hat, but the gun isn't mine. I need to return it to its owner.
And who is that?
Can I have it back, please?
She stood there seething, then said, It's been in safekeeping. Wait here.
She went into the dining room. He heard her open one of the sideboard's drawers, then slam it shut. She reappeared with his hat in one hand and the Colt in the other. She thrust them at him. He caught them both against his chest.
Thanks.
He placed his hat on his head and pushed the pistol into his waistband.
You're going to walk around town with it poking out like that?
No, I'm going to ride around town with it poking out like that.
Ride?
He thumbed over his shoulder toward her backyard, where he'd hitched a gelding to a post of her clothesline. She glanced past him, saw the horse, and remarked, again snidely,
He doesn't look like a bucking bronco to me.
Far from it. He's lazy. His owner hired me to pump some spirit into him. Riding him over was a lesson in obedience.
For him or for you?
I got him up to a canter. For me, it beat walking.
The scornfulness in her expression was replaced by one of sudden realization.
When you left last night?
Yeah, I was afoot, but I'm used to walking. He didn't see a need to belabor the point. Corinne and I will ride double. Go get her and we'll be out of your hair.
She hesitated, tugging at her lower lip with her teeth, and damn if he didn't want to be doing that. Sore as he was at her in his head, other parts of him hadn't gotten the message. She said,
Did Corinne express a desire to go with you?
You mean just now? No. She was bringing me up to date on Irv. Sounds like he's doing okay.
Ornery, as you predicted, but holding his own.
Have you changed the bandage?
Not yet, but he isn't running a fever, so I don't think the wound is infected.
Want me to stay while you check, then help you wrap him up again?
No, I wouldn't want to inconvenience you any more than you already have been.
She clasped her hands at her waist and avoided looking him in the eye.
In fact, Irv asked me to tell you, on the outside chance that you and I met again, that he's grateful for what you did and to give you his thanks.
He said that?
Specifically.
He propped his shoulder against the door jamb and folded his arms.
Now I wonder who that pained the most. You for having to pass along his thanks, or him for owing me his thanks in the first place?
My gratitude is sincere, Mr. Hutton. So is Irv's.
Then he's changed his opinion of me?
Why would you say that?
When you two came into the sheriff's office while I was in custody, the second he saw me, he said, Didn't I tell you he was up to no good? Meaning that before he'd even met me, before he'd ever looked me in the eye, he'd drawn that conclusion and shared it with you.
He uncrossed his arms and pushed off the doorframe to face her squarely. Watching closely to see how she would react, he added,
Which, I guess, is why he went for his shotgun that day I wandered into your yard.
Shotgun?
No sense in lying. I saw him. Why'd he have that shotgun at the ready?
Noticeably uneasy, she said,
He's leery of strangers.
Overmuch, I'd say.
He kept a shotgun handy as a precaution, to protect Pearl and me if the need arose.
But I hadn't done anything out of line. You said so yourself. You told the sheriff that
I know what I told him.
Then why did your father-in-law feel he had to stand guard?
His persistence had turned her uneasiness into annoyance.
Maybe it's your overall manner, Mr. Hutton.
What manner is that?
The way you look at a person, like you're trying to figure them out.
Sometimes I am.
Well, it's rude and unnerving. It makes people uncomfortable.
You especially, I think.
Dander up, she said.
Not at all.
Then why'd you go all jumpy last night?
I didn't go jumpy.
He snuffled. She'd played right into his gambit. When she realized it, she looked away from him, then turned and looked behind her toward Irv's bedroom before coming back around to him. Her expression was now prim as a nun's.
You deliberately got us off the subject of Corinne, she said. In good conscience, I can't send her back to the roadhouse and that Gert who has been so cruel to her.
she wanted out of there, all right. But where can she go?
I'm willing to take her in. She'll have a place to live, and I'll pay her a modest salary to work for me. With Irv incapacitated, I could use the extra help with my business. Corinne is eager to improve her lot in life.
Sounds good all around, but it seems sudden.
Well, she was suddenly foisted on me, wasn't she? I thought she would be relieved. This will free you from any responsibility you feel toward her.
Not entirely. He hitched his chin toward the bedroom. How's Corinne feel about this arrangement?
Irv is talking it over with her now. He's confident that she'll jump at the chance, and so am I. It's certainly preferable to the situation she was in at Lefty's.
How'd she wind up there? Did she tell you?
She was naive and trusting of a man. She's paying the consequences of having stars in her eyes. They can be blinding.
She looked down at her open palm and ran her other thumb over the pinprick in the center. Then she dropped her hand and hid it in a fold of her skirt, as though she'd been caught with it in the cookie jar.
I shouldn't have let you kiss me last night, Mr. Hutton. But neither should you have taken advantage of me when I was in such a state. So we were both at fault for things getting out of hand. Don't even think of it ever happening again. The incident will never be mentioned. We'll pretend that it didn't happen. No, we'll forget that it happened.
He didn't say anything.
She didn't look into his face, but continued to stare straight ahead at the button on his shirt to which she'd issued the ultimatum about pretending and forgetting. He waited her out. Finally, she tilted her head back and met his eyes.
That's how it's going to be.
Is that right?
She went rigid with indignation and made a sound of disgust.
I knew you'd be difficult about it.
She elbowed him aside and went out into the yard. She strode over to the horse. The gelding shied, taking several cautious steps backward. She untied the reins from around the post, then tugged on them until the reluctant horse went along as she led him over to Thatcher.
Here.
She held out the reins.
Goodbye.
Thatcher took the reins, then caught her hand and walked her backward until she came up against the gelding's side, the back of her head resting against the seat of the saddle. Thatcher cupped the horn with his left hand and placed his right on the cantle, bracketing her with his arms. He could tell the action shocked her, but he didn't give her time to counter.
You've said your piece. Now I'm going to say mine. I like the look of you. Have since I first laid eyes on you. That soft spot right there where your lips meet was the first place I wanted to kiss.
He homed in on that spot, then his eyes trailed down her front and back up again.
I like the size and shape of you. I like everything. Even your sass. Mostly your sass, he said, his gaze dipping briefly to her lips again before returning to her eyes. As for not thinking about that kiss ever happening again, I've already thought about it, and more. I think about you unbuttoned and unhooked and with your hair loose. I have dreams where we're lying down together, and I hate like hell waking up.
He shifted his stance, still not touching her, but coming awfully close, and it was hard as hell not to give in to the urge to bring them flush like they'd been last night.
Now, Laurel, I've never taken advantage of a woman in my life. You damn well know that I didn't take advantage of you last night, and I won't, ever.
He dropped his voice so she'd have to listen really close to this last part, because it was an ultimatum of his own.
But if you genuinely don't want me coming at you again, be careful you don't dare me.
He gave the words seconds to sink in, then lowered his hands from the saddle, moved her aside, put his boot in the stirrup, and swung up. He nudged the gelding with his knees and rode out of the yard without looking back. Thatcher had another difficult encounter ahead of him this morning. He'd said what he'd wanted to say to Laurel, but in doing so had probably offended her beyond any hope of ever making amends. But if he had to do it over again, he'd say the same. He feared things wouldn't go any better with Bill Amos. The sheriff's car wasn't parked out front of the department, but Thatcher went inside to check if he was there.
Three personnel were inside, but Harold was the only one Thatcher knew by name. All stopped what they were doing when he walked in. Harold said,
"Sheriff's not here."
"Do you know where he is?"
"At home."
"I have business with him."
"What kind of business?"
Harold had covered his back last night during the raid, but the resentment persisted, it seemed.
"The kind that won't wait. Where does he live?"
The Amos's house wasn't as picturesque as Dr. Driscoll's, but the second-story roofline sported gingerbread trim. It overhung a deep porch with two wicker rocking chairs. The yard was shaded by a massive pecan tree loaded with clusters of green shucks that promised a good harvest come fall. Thatcher secured the gelding to a fence post, made his way up the limestone walk, and knocked on the front door. The upper half of it had an oval glass pane, through which Thatcher and the sheriff made eye contact as he approached. He was in shirt sleeves and seemed a bit thrown to see Thatcher at his door. He greeted him by name with a question mark behind it.
"I stopped by your office first. Harold told me where you lived. Can I have a minute?"
The sheriff turned his head and glanced up the staircase attached to the right wall of the vestibule. He came back around, smoothing his mustache.
"All right, come in."
Thatcher took off his hat and stepped inside. On the wall opposite the staircase was a gallery of framed photographs, but the foyer was dim, and Thatcher couldn't make out who was in the pictures.
"How bad off is Irv Plummer?" Bill asked.
"He'll live. The bullet entered the back of his arm here,"
Thatcher illustrated.
"Came out through his armpit. Lost blood, but it wasn't as nasty as it could have been."
"What about the other injured?"
"Bloody noses and scraped knuckles, one broken finger. Four were shot, including Irv. None of the wounds were fatal or permanently crippling, thank God."
"Who was the shooter?"
"Local boy, preacher's kid. Stupid and blind drunk. He panicked, overreacted. Broke down and cried when we told him that his wild shots had found flesh. More scared of his daddy's punishment than jail time. We've got a dozen in the cell block sleeping it off until they can be arraigned later today. Lefty's lawyer has already posted bail for him and Gert."
"Routine," he said with a shrug.
"How was Mrs. Plummer when you got Irv home?"
"Scared at first, seeing the blood. But once the shock wore off and she realized the wound wasn't fatal, she was fine."
"Third crisis in a row for that young lady."
"Another would be having the old man sent to jail. Do you plan on arresting him?"
"Not this time. But he should learn his lesson from getting shot and stay out of Lefty's."
Thatcher didn't comment on that. He pulled the pistol from his waistband and extended it to Bill by the barrel.
"Wasn't fired. Wasn't needed after all."
"Why don't you keep it, Thatcher?"
"No, thanks."
"Why not?"
"I've already got one. It was a gift. This one comes with strings."
With a sigh of resignation, Bill took the Colt and set it on the lengthy table that ran along the wall under the picture gallery.
"Look, I can tell that you're upset about—"
"I'm not upset, Bill. I'm pissed off. You roped me into something I wanted no part of. And it's not like I hadn't told you, flat out, that I wanted no part of it."
"Guilty. But last night you only proved that you—"
"Bill?"
The feminine voice came from above. Thatcher looked up the staircase where a woman hovered halfway down. She was of comparable age to Bill, maybe 50. She was wearing a dressing gown and bedroom slippers. Her long, pale hair hung loose and tangled almost to her waist. She looked like a disheveled angel, a remarkably beautiful angel. And she was regarding Thatcher with as much awe as he was regarding her. With gentleness, Bill said,
"Daisy, go on back upstairs. I'll be there in a sec."
She eased her grip on the banister and continued her descent. But it was as plain as day to Thatcher that she was drunk or high on something. Her tread was so unsteady that if Bill hadn't bounded up to assist her down the last few steps, she surely would have fallen. When they reached the bottom, she shuffled toward Thatcher, bringing with her a waft of whiskey.
She laid her frail hand against his chest as she gazed up at him with a yearning that made Thatcher uncomfortable. He looked over at Bill, who was watching his wife with sorrow, pity, and love, the raw and tragic kind.
"Daisy, this is Thatcher Hutton. Remember I told you about him?"
In a breathy voice, she said,
"For a moment there, I thought, with the light behind him, the angle of his jaw, he looked..."
She trailed off, and turning away from Thatcher, said to her husband,
"They do make mistakes. I've read stories."
Bill placed his arm around her shoulders.
"I don't think it's a mistake, Daisy."
She looked toward the photo gallery, then pressed her face into Bill's shirt front and began making keening sounds that made chills run down Thatcher's spine. Bill shushed her, then turned with her toward the stairs, saying to Thatcher over his shoulder,
"Wait for me on the porch."
Thatcher quietly slipped through the front door. Fucking hell, this was turning out to be some morning. He sat down in one of the rocking chairs and stared at the gelding, whose head drooped in the mid-morning heat. He was too lazy even to graze at the patch of grass within nibbling distance. Thatcher actually preferred a horse that would stamp and rear and buck him off a dozen times to one he had to light a fire under. Neither he nor the horse moved much in the 10 minutes before Bill came through the door, pulling it closed behind him. He avoided looking at Thatcher as he dragged the other rocking chair over and lowered himself into it, settling heavily. He rested his head against the back of it and closed his eyes, his bearing one of utter despair and defeat. Thatcher took his cue from Bill and remained silent. After a time, Bill sat forward and placed his forearms on his thighs, linking his fingers between his knees and staring at the floor planks under his boots.
"Daisy has a heart condition. You see? Her heart is broken. Shattered, actually. The declines I told you about are actually drinking binges. When I got home last night, she was passed out. I couldn't wake her up. Scares me shitless when I find her like that. I stayed home this morning, waiting for her to wake up, bathe, to eat something."
He made a rolling motion with his hand.
"You get it."
Thatcher nodded, but Bill had yet to look at him, so he didn't see the nod. He said the first thing that came to mind, and it was in earnest.
"She's beautiful."
Bill gave a sniff of rueful humor.
"First time I saw her, swear to God, I don't think I took a breath for 5 full minutes. It was at a community picnic on the 4th of July. She had on a white dress and carried a parasol. I drew her attention by winning a shooting contest. She strolled over to congratulate me on my blue ribbon. I don't remember what we said to each other. I doubt I made a lick of sense."
He paused and smiled at the recollection.
"Anyhow, I started courting her the next day. A few months later, I asked for her hand, and she said yes. I thought for sure she was taunting me, but no, she was in earnest. I marched her to First Methodist before she could change her mind. Our son Tim was born 9 months later, almost to the day of the wedding."
During his next pause, his smile faded.
"But after Tim, she couldn't conceive. That boy became the light of our lives. We loved him. Most everybody who met him did. The good die young, they say."
He gulped, and it took a while for him to continue.
"We never saw his body, didn't have a casket. We put up a marker in the cemetery, but Daisy can't accept that he's gone. I know it was eerie for you, the way she was staring. I apologize. She thinks she sees Tim and every young man who's the right age and of similar build. You do resemble him that way. She drinks herself into stupors. Some last hours, some for days. Every once in a while, she can pull herself together and make an effort to be her old self, the belle of the ball, but not often."
Thatcher shifted in his seat.
"Have you thought of taking her to a sanatorium?" 1,000 times a day. But I can't bring myself to do it, Thatcher. I can't do that to either of us. Being locked up might send her over a cliff to where I couldn't reach. I wouldn't have anything of her, and I'd rather have this than nothing.
Where does she get the hooch?
He looked over at Thatcher then, and in his eyes was a shameful confession.
That's why I told you it would be messy if I tried to charge our mayor with bootlegging. Not just messy, but hypocritical. He supplies me with the good stuff from Kentucky.
He might not if he knew it wasn't for you, if he knew it was Mrs. Amos who was drinking it.
Oh, he knows. He takes perverse pleasure in her addiction and our sad, sad circumstance.
He gave Thatcher another rueful smile.
He was Daisy's escort to the picnic.
33. Chester Landry was in conversation with Mr. Hancock and one of his female customers. She was effusively extolling the quality and styling of her recently purchased shoes. With matching effusiveness, Landry complimented her on how well she wore them. She simpered, Mr. Hancock suggested she buy an additional pair, and Landry's eye was caught by Jimmy Hennessy, who was paying for a purchase at the cash register. Croft's bodyguard tipped his head toward the door. Landry excused himself from the merchant and the woman, telling them how badly he regretted being unable to stay longer, and exited the store. Hennessy was staring into one of the store's display windows and didn't even turn his head in Landry's direction as he said,
"He wants to see you."
5 minutes later, Landry entered the municipal building through a back entrance and took a private staircase that led to a side door of the mayor's office, bypassing his secretary. This door was used only by Bernie's inner circle and individuals like Sheriff Amos, who came to pick up their graft. Landry tapped on the door and was told to come in. Concealing his displeasure over being marshaled, he said,
"Good morning, Bernie."
He walked over to his customary chair and took a seat. Bernie, seated behind his desk, was fiddling with a sterling silver letter opener. Landry got the sense he was testing its worth as a weapon. He said,
"I understand there was some excitement at Lefty's last night."
"Yes, rip-roaring."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
Landry's head went back an inch. He cocked an eyebrow.
"If you know, then obviously you didn't need me to tell you."
"I want to hear your account of it, Chester."
He raised his shoulders.
"It was a raid. Typical in execution and response. People scattered and fled. Heads were knocked. I'm sure there were some arrests, but I have a lot of practice at avoiding arrest, and I succeeded in doing so last night."
"In company?"
"I was there by myself. Prior to the bust-in, I chatted with Lefty. He placed his standard order, but you'll be pleased to hear that I talked him into taking an extra case of that expensive Canadian."
He paused, then said,
"You still look perturbed."
"Thatcher Hutton was at Lefty's last night."
"Hutton? He wasn't in the back room, I'm certain."
"No, he was out front."
"He must have taken his own recommendation."
"Explain that."
"At dinner, last week. He said he'd heard Lefty's hamburgers were good. I guess he decided to try one."
"He didn't go for a hamburger. He was there with Bill Amos."
That took Landry by surprise.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure," Bernie replied testily. "Hutton took part in the raid on the side of the sheriff's department. Not all of Bill's men are happy about it either. There's grousing in the ranks. First, Hutton is in cuffs. Now he's in our sheriff's back pocket."
"And the sheriff is in yours,"
Landry returned mildly. This was a development he hadn't foreseen. Last week, Hutton had claimed that he had no plans, that he was taking things one day at a time. His sudden change of course needed to be explored, but in a cool-headed manner. Bernie was fuming, and that bothered Landry. First, because his anger was so apparent,
and secondly, because angry people made rash decisions in order to put a quick end to an unexpected problem. He needed to talk him down.
Actually, Bernie, you should be relieved.
Why in hell?
Because if Hutton is wearing a badge and carrying out raids, he isn't working undercover.
Not necessarily.
But improbably.
Well, I don't like it. I don't like him. You two live in the same boarding house. Keep an eye on him.
Landry steepled his fingers and tapped them against his chin.
He's no fool, Bernie. He won't be as easily manipulated as Randy was.
I'm confident you'll handle him with your usual finesse.
I'm glad we agree on that.
Landry got up and went to the door. Hand on the knob, he turned back.
You were entirely right to tell me about Hutton's new status. I needed to know.
But I disliked being summoned. I'm not one of the good old boys you have at your beck and call, Bernie.
Don't ever send that Mick Lummox of yours after me again.
34. Gabe Driscoll was appalled by Norma's recklessness.
What the devil are you thinking, showing up here in broad daylight?
I suggest you let me in. It wouldn't do for your nosy neighbors to see you refusing to examine a pediatric patient, no matter how closeted you are.
He glanced down at the bundle in her arms.
The baby's sick?
He's as healthy as a horse, but they don't know that.
She shoved past Gabe and entered the house. He took a furtive look up and down the street. Norma's sister's automobile was the only one in sight, but Patsy wasn't in it. He shut the door.
You drove yourself?
I wanted us to be alone.
Without invitation, Norma went into the parlor.
This room is like a dungeon.
Why don't you raise the shades and open the drapes?
Never mind the drapes, Norma. I told you not to come here.
You gave me no choice. You haven't kept your promise to come see Arthur and me.
I couldn't get away.
What's keeping you occupied? Not your practice. The sign out front says you're still closed.
People are watching me.
People? She said, sputtering a laugh. What people?
All people, he shouted. My every move incites speculation on what really happened to Mila.
You're imagining things.
He chewed the inside of his cheek.
Maybe, to an extent.
But we have to be discreet, Norma. Why can't you understand that?
I do understand it. I just hate being apart.
She came toward him, her gait that of a stalking predator. He was easy prey. He swelled inside his trousers, just as he had the first time he saw her. Patsy had been suffering a racking cough, and Norma had brought her to him for treatment. While he'd been pressing his stethoscope against her sister's chest and listening to her wheezing lungs, Norma had been toying with the strand of beads lying against her own chest and drawing his attention to her